Welcome to episode 42 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Drew Matat, who, like so many papermakers I talk to, stumbled upon the medium by chance when he was at Buffalo State College, where he wanted to study film. He took paper and printmaking classes with Peter Sawicki, who told him something Drew has carried through his work today. There are no secrets in papermaking. If we kept secrets, these traditions would be lost. Drew tells me about his first paper project, when he took some of his father's clothing. Drew's father died when he was just 5 years old, and transformed it into sheets of paper and ultimately a book of poems and photographs. Listen to Drew's heartfelt account of the cutting up of those rags with his brothers, sister, and mother, and how that process led to the sharing of stories Drew and his siblings had never heard before. We talk about how this led to combat paper, which involves the transformation of military uniforms into sheets of handmade paper, and Peace Paper Project, which has facilitated the setup of 40 papermaking studios around the world over the past several years, each one working with survivors of illness, sexual abuse, or war. We chat about the unique business model of Peace Paper and the most recent developments, including a DIY Hollander beater and St. Pauli Paper Studio, a new papermaking studio in Hamburg, Germany. Enjoy our conversation.
Okay, well, Drew Matat, welcome to Paper Talk. I think the first time I met you was in Washington, D.C. at a Friends of Dard Hunter conference, and you and Drew Cameron gave a very emotional and heartfelt talk. It was really exciting. The energy was in the room. So welcome.
No, thank you very much. I'm excited to be with you.
Yeah, and you're living in Hamburg, Germany now. Do you speak German?
Oh, I'm busy.
I'm busy.
A little bit. I'm taking classes, so I have 5 years to pass the exam. I am at a comfortable A1 level, which is the lowest level you can get. And I'm about to take my third round of the first level of courses, mostly because I travel so much, so I haven't been able to finish them.
Right. But okay.
I speak a little bit. Everybody here speaks such great English that it's actually kind of difficult to learn Deutsch. It's one of the challenges, I think. So
right.
all my friends now on this time coming back, they're like, we're only going to speak to you in German. And I'm like, please, this will help me survive the next great apocalypse. So
yeah.
I appreciate that. But it's definitely one of the challenges. But yeah, I'm learning German for sure. I have to.
Cool. Okay, well, let's start talking about how you got interested in paper.
Oh my God. How did I get into papermaking? I think that really, for me, all my personal credit for how I got into papermaking goes to Peter Sawicki and Paul Martin at Buffalo State College. So back in 1998, I enrolled in Buffalo State thinking I was getting into a program to study film. And they were like, no, we don't offer film here, but you can take a bunch of fine art classes and transfer to the University of Buffalo. And yeah, so I was like, huh, that's kind of a bummer. I wish I could study film because that's really what I wanted to do. And during that first semester, I took an introduction to printmaking class with Peter Sawicki. And the way that Peter and Paul ran the printmaking program is they kind of shared the students and they would come in and kind of work with you, individually and together. And so I really got to know Peter Sawicki and Paul Martin through my studies there, studying printmaking. And at the end of that semester, Peter came to me and said, we would like you to stick around for one more semester to take a class called papermaking. And I remember thinking, you've got to be kidding me. That's like, what is papermaking? I just imagined a bunch of little old ladies like knitting or crocheting or something. Like I had this image. I had no idea that you could even study it. And Peter said, we think that papermaking is something that you would really do well with based on the kind of prints that I was doing. I was doing these large format kind of hand hand-printed images based on my film stills. And I thought, oh man, you gotta be kidding me. But I really like Peter and I really like Paul. And so I said, okay, I'll stick around and I'll take this class. That means I get to work with you guys. And I really like your energy and I like the space. And so I continued at Buffalo State College the second semester, and I wasn't planning on, so I had to contact University of Buffalo and basically put my film career on pause. And when I showed up to that first papermaking class, Peter did something that was really amazing. You know, he gave a little talk about his recent travels at that time, his recent travels, and I think it was Vietnam. And he showed all these images of different paper mills and how people were making paper. And it was very intriguing. You know, I was like, oh, this is a different culture. Wow, they're making this stuff called paper. And it was before we had even made paper. So it was his introduction to papermaking thing. And one of the things he said was, he said, there are no secrets in papermaking. He's like, if we kept secrets, then these traditions would be completely lost. And so he said, ask me any questions about the process, about why they're making paper, about how they did it, about the different fibers. And he said, I'm here to basically pass this information on to you so that you can then pass it on to the world and keep hand paper making going. And that was so antithetical to what I was experiencing in my film studies. When I would hang out with my film friends, everybody kept everything so close to their chest, you know, and everything was like a tightly guarded secret. Only your friends knew what you were working on. And I really like that openness to it. And that's something that I carry with me to, you know, through combat paper and peace paper and all these different programs, is the idea of sharing as much information and getting as much of these techniques and skill sets out there and activating individuals with this knowledge as a way to propagate hand papermaking. So that was probably, you know, that was day one of papermaking. I was like, wow, cool. This is a skill set. This is a process that my professor was saying, let's share it, which is totally different than what I was experiencing. So immediately I was interested in paper from that moment. And, you know, Peter has got this great way of kind of getting his students involved. Like, we rolled out felts the first day and we were cutting up felts and just doing kind of like rolling up our sleeves and doing hard work before we actually even got to cutting rag or, you know, using the Hollinger beaters and then, of course, forming sheets of paper. And so I liked that too. I liked how we were involved in all the steps of the process. So again, this is something that I've carried with me to the work that I do today. But during that first semester, the thing that really, really kind of has put me to where I am today was, you know, learning that I could make paper out of my clothing. Got me excited. And so I went home to my apartment and I started to pull out all my old like flannel shirts and old blue jeans that were like stained with printmaking debris and stuff like that. And I brought them into the studio and I cut them up. And I liked that I had this personal connection with the material, you know, that I was cutting it up and it was my clothing and I could run it through the Hollinger. And so I kind of owned it. And then, you know, the printmaking studio was only a couple floors right above the paper studio. And so I could bring this freshly formed sheets of paper, these freshly formed sheets of paper up into the print studio and then print on it. And then there was this like another connection to the process. Like I was kind of afraid to print onto the paper because maybe the matrix that I was printing didn't fit with my story. And so I realized that I had this like ability to control the story and the end result of the fine art piece through the media of the paper. So through starting with the story of the rag and the content in the rag. And so that really turned me on and helped direct my printing projects. And so immediately I figured that out. I was like, oh, I don't want to print pictures of, you know, George Bush or whatever onto my clothing because it didn't make any sense. You know, people would ask, why did you print it onto this? Mm-hmm. It didn't really correspond or relate. So I started to look at the fiber source as the beginning or a major component to the printmaking projects I was running. So if I was doing a piece about American nationalism, which I did quite a bit in those days, I was, you know, went and bought American flags and then cut them up and then pulped them and then printed on them. If I was doing something about blue collar workers or like social justice issues, I was selecting the rag material based on the story in them and then bringing, you know, pulping that and bringing it up and then printing on top of it. So I really like that part of it. I like being out in the world and then kind of looking around me and seeing what people are wearing as possible stories or possible content to transform into paper and then print on. And you know, that's really what kept me going back to the studio. It's like, oh, I wanna make something out of the American flag. I wanna make something out of blue jeans and blue, you know, white collar shirts, you know, to provide commentary in the print studio. And so I cut up stuff and was pulping and really got into that process. But when I was, during that first semester, when I was home on break, I carried this kind of energy with me. And when I was younger, my father was killed in a car accident. So mm-hmm. when I was five, my father was killed. And my father was, you know, studied Buckminster Fuller's philosophies. Mm-hmm. He was an anti-war activist. And he traveled around the United States building geodesic domes during the late 60s and early 70s. Mm. And so when I was home on break, I went into his old study, and the way that we would remember, or I guess find time and space with our father, was we would pull out this old cardboard box, and you could go through his architectural drawings and his letters to Jimmy Carter and see the old photographs and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. when I was home on break, I did this. I went into his old study and I pulled out the cardboard box and I put it down on the desk and I kind of started going through it. And at the bottom of it was a pair of blue jeans that were paint encrusted and a couple of t-shirts and a handkerchief. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I touched that, my first thought was, what would this be like to transform into paper? Like, what would I do with this? What would it be like?
Right.
And so I pulled it out and I brought it to my mom and I said, hey, mom, I'd like to transform dad's stuff into paper. And she was like, please don't do that. That's all that we have left of him. And he said, but if you leave it out, let me think about it. She's like, what would you do with it? I was like, I don't know. Cut it up and put it in the machine and make paper. And so she came to me during, you know, a couple days later and was like, I think it would be interesting if you did make paper out of his old clothes, and then could you print some of his poems and some of his photographs onto the paper and make enough copies for everybody in the family? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's a really interesting idea. Mm-hmm. So I come from a small Catholic family. So I have five brothers and one sister. And I called up my brothers and my sister and we said, hey, we're going to cut up dad's old clothing and make it into paper. Would you like to come? And so we all gathered around the dining room table and we took scissors to his clothing and cut it into little pieces. And through that process, it was very interesting. My mom got to tell us stories about how she met my dad, what it was like kind of, you know, being involved with this anti-war activist who was traveling around the country, what it was like protesting the, you know, joining protests, the anti-war protests in New York. She was at New York University, and what it was like kind of dating and then being married to and having children with this wandering, traveling artist. So we heard lots of different stories that we had never heard, and we found a connection, you know, with my father, with our father, through these kinds of stories. And my brothers and my sister and I told stories about what it was like to grow up without a father figure. I think this was probably more important for us. You know, mm-hmm. we realized that we kind of all gravitated towards the male figures in our lives. Like for me, it was my hockey coach or my track coach or my history teacher, you know. And for my brothers and my sister, it might have been their math instructor or their chemistry instructor or their chess coach or something like that. And so we kind of shared stories and we talked about all these things. And we realized that all our main people that we were attracted to in school, and we stayed after school to be a part of these programs, were male. And so we realized that that was a way for us to kind of fill our the father figure in our lives. And so the whole time we were, removing buttons and, taking the zippers off and like tearing and kind of cutting the material up. And then I took that material back to Buffalo and I pulped it and I made a couple hundred sheets of paper out of it. And then I took all of the contents in the box. So I brought the box with me and I scanned it and created all sorts of different plates, whether they were, etching or screen prints or whatever. And then I printed the entire contents of the box onto paper, both commercial papers, also papers that we made for my dad's clothes. And I created an edition of, I think it was about 13 books. And I interwove like facsimiles, like the stuff that I'd reproduced, and then actually the original pieces throughout these editions. And I wanted to recreate the feeling of that you were kind of taking this box down and going through it. So it was just, I wanted this fresh feeling of experiencing my father's story. And when I finished that book, I brought it back home. So when I went home for summer, and I hand delivered it to all of my brothers and my sister. And they were like, oh, interesting. This is, this is very unique. This is very cool. Thank you very much for this. But what was really, I think, meaningful for me was when I brought it to my father's siblings, so my aunts and uncles, and I would call them up. I called them up and made a little appointment to have tea or coffee or just meet with them so that I could share this book and then give them a copy. So I made a copy for everybody in my father's family and everybody in my family. And in particular, when I brought it to my uncle, who was closest to my father in age, he was an architect and a builder, similar to my father. And I showed up and I was like, hi, this is what I did with my dad's book, And he was like, huh, okay. And I handed him the book and he opened it up. And as you open the book, the end pages are my father's passport photos, kind of with marbled backgrounds. And my uncle, who was a very kind of hard, conservative man, immediately closed it. Mm-hmm. And he put it on his desk and he sat down and he put his hand on the book and he just started to cry.
Wow.
And I was like, oh no, what did I do? And he just started to tell me stories about my father, growing up with my father, going sledding, playing ice hockey, playing ball, dating. He told me all these stories about what it was like to grow up with somebody and then have them leave their life so immediately. My father was killed in a car accident, so it was very abrupt.
Yeah.
And when my father was only 31 when he was killed, so he lived a very short life. So he kind of was telling all these different stories and kind of in the process, he picked up the book and he started to go through it, and, he told me how much it meant to him to have something, a memory, something that commemorates his brother's life. And one of the things that came out through his stories was that something I completely was unaware of and didn't know about was that when the Vietnam War was started, my uncle felt like it was his duty to enlist in the service and go fight the communists and protect American democracy through, joining the military. And my father felt like it was his duty, to burn his draft card and join the anti-war movement and protect democracy by being a voice against the war in Vietnam. And ever since that time, their relationship wasn't completely severed, but it was definitely stressed. Mm-hmm. And they never found a resolve in their relationship. And so my uncle just, said, I don't know what it was all about. And I feel so bad that we had this fight and that we never figured it out. And so we had this great sense of remorse and regret. And so that was something I never was aware of until that moment. And every time I would go back to visit my uncle, he always had two books on his desk. He had my father's book and the Bible. And so I'd go to visit him quite often. Every time I was home on break, I'd go to visit him in his old shop. And he would grab my father's book and just randomly open it up to a page or a photograph. And he would read a line, or he'd read a poem, or he would tell a story. And it was his way of bringing his relationship with my father back and finding a sense of resolve, you know. And I think for me, that whole relationship was what kind of turned me on to papermaking, to realize that the paper arts and the book arts had this ability to have a profound impact and effect on somebody's life, not just like making paper and putting it on the wall in the gallery and having people kind of shuffle by and look at it and respond, but actually having a real like emotional impact. And so I was like, wow, paper is pretty awesome stuff. And
So let me get a little word in here. Your storytelling is wonderful though. Wow. That's an amazing story. And yes, you've carried so much of that through to your work today. So let's move right along just for the sake of time.
Of course.
And tell me about your involvement with Green Door Studio, and then that led to Combat Paper, I think, correct?
Yeah, and I can move through the Green Door stuff pretty quickly. But after I finished my undergraduate studies with Peter Sawitsky and Paul Martin, I moved to Burlington, Vermont with my girlfriend. And we wanted to, have our own art-making studio space. So we basically rented a big flat, and I wanted to make paper. So I bought a Hollander beater and set up the papermaking operation and started to teach papermaking workshops. You know, at first it was just, just putting a call in the newspaper and saying, hey, on Saturday, we're going to have a papermaking workshop, bring me $30 and we can make paper.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually I started to teach papermaking at the community college. And I think they were like $10 sessions. They were super inexpensive. And the idea was to get people down to the studio, get them engaged in making paper and just sharing in the fun of making paper. It was really what it was about. And one of the things I did do was every once a month, I had like these open studios down at the studio where people could just bring in an article of clothing that had some kind of story, or it had their own, like had personal content. So it wasn't mm-hmm. just like taking old office paper and shredding it up, or taking right. abaca and cotton and making paper with pigments or something. It was like a way for people to kind of have a direct connection with the papermaking process. And one of my friends had his partner had recently passed away from cancer. And so he contacted me and said, I would like to come to your studio and attend one of these workshops and transform my partner's clothing into paper and print some of her writings and her photographs onto the paper and make a book out of it like you did with your father. And so he came and he stayed for about 3 weeks, I think, and he made 500 sheets of paper from her clothing and just, printed all this stuff and bound the books.
So I want to ask you a question. In the case like that, mm-hmm. were you still cutting with scissors? And when you had a workshop where people could bring an article of clothing, how did you handle beating the separate items? Because I know you've come to develop ways of doing things quicker.
Quicker.
Was it all pretty?
back then it was a lot more slow because we used to cook the fiber, which I don't do. Oh. I haven't done that in 15 years. Uh-huh. What I would do during these workshops is people would cut up material. We would cook it. We'd have these cookers and I would do the tea bag method. So I'd get a boil going and I'd put everybody's stuff in the pot, but separate it by the paint strainers.
Okay.
And kind of throw it in there and cook it. And then, we would process people's materials. There were long days. But I ended up cutting most of the material, I would say all the material, with some kind of cotton linter or something.
Okay.
I had a little pound and a half Valley Hollander that was from 1935 or something. So it was pretty old and took a long time. So we did small loads and people might make like 4 or 5 sheets of paper during these workshops. They didn't make a lot of paper.
But how long were you beating each batch?
Oh, must be probably half hour or so.
Okay. So you could churn through a few.
Yeah, but yeah. We did small loads.
Yeah.
For these kinds of workshops. But generally speaking, there was only maybe somewhere between 4 and 6 people that would come in.
Right.
Engage. And I always had pulp set up so that while stuff was beating, people could make paper out of stock fibers or things that I was working with. And okay. So while they were waiting for their rag to be beat, they were making paper with house fibers, you could call it, just stuff that I had prepared ahead of time. During those sessions, it was a way to kind of engage with the community and get people interested in paper making. And it was through one of the community college workshops that I did that Drew Cameron came in. He was he'd recently come back from Iraq, the service in the Iraq War, and was with the Vermont National Guard. So he was doing his post-service service. Mm-hmm. And he enrolled at the Community College of Vermont and saw this sign that we were having this $10 papermaking workshop. And his father had introduced him to papermaking in Iowa City through Tim Barrett, really. And so he said, hey, I know about paper. I want to get involved with that. So he came down and we made paper together. And we became fast friends and started making paper. And he joined the papermaking studio. You know, it's like $100 a month or something to have 24-hour access to the paper studio. And he was always coming down and making paper out of different clothes, different materials, you know, cooking. You know, I taught him everything I knew, which was everything that Paul Martin and Peter Sawicki had taught me. And during that process, I guess through that friendship, Drew Cameron and I kind of really bonded. He started to have he started to bring down photographs from his service. You know, one day when he brought in photographs and the Iraqi currency and stuff like that, and he's like, hey, you know, if you have any questions about my experience in the military, I'd love to talk about it. You know, I'd like to share it. Uh-huh. And I remember all these little the old school photographs, you know, out on the table, and he was telling stories about his time when he served, and he was showing me different things that he brought back. And, you know, outside of my uncle, I had never met anybody who was in the service. Mm-hmm. So that was very new to me. And I was intrigued by his willingness to share, you know, his time and what that meant. It was meaningful for him. And so when I eventually went to Columbia College, Chicago, and when I left Burlington, instead of packing up the Green Door Studio and the whole papermaking operation, I basically handed it off to Drew Cameron to run. I was like, well, it doesn't make sense for me to put this in storage. Like, if you sign the lease and take this space over, then you can continue to run this papermaking studio in this community art center. And so he did. And he was increasingly getting more involved with the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and using his experience in the military as a way to speak out against the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the programs that he hosted down at the Green Door Studio during those early days was a Warrior Writers kind of creative writing session, and. Mm-hmm. I think there was like 8 maybe veterans and one of the other instructors that came down, and they did a whole creative writing, you know, weekend of writing poems and kind of speaking about their time in their service. And what he did was he set up a bunch of papermaking vats. I think it was just abaca and some other fibers, and they were pulling sheets of paper as a way to kind of like just let their hair down and kind of relax and get involved with, he wanted to share papermaking with them. So get involved with papermaking. And he called me and he told me about what they were doing when I was in Chicago. And I said, oh, that's interesting. One of the things you might consider doing is transforming an old military uniform into paper pulp and using that as the material that you guys pulp. And he was like, huh. And I was like, huh. Interesting. We both were like, huh. And so I kind of like went into the studio, and I think I went to a thrift shop in Chicago and bought an old BDU and transformed it into pulp and made paper just to see if it was even possible, because there's so much polyester and stuff in the uniform. And what DeCam did was he actually went down and he cut up his what do they call it? The DCUs, the desert camouflage uniform that he had most recently worn in his time in Iraq. And he like did it as a piece where he cut it directly from his body and then transformed it into paper pulp, and then made about 300 sheets of paper and started to share the paper. So yeah, he cut up his military uniform directly off his body and made about 300 sheets of paper and started to share that with people that he was working with, other veterans that he was working with in the Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Wounded Warriors Program, sorry, the Warrior Writers Program. And people just like, they started to show up at the Green Door with their sea bags full of uniforms saying, we want to transform our uniforms into paper. So as soon as he kind of broadcast that he had cut up his uniform, just quite literally through letters and poems and through just sharing it, people started to come to the studio and he had an open door policy, like, come on in and let's make paper. Let's, you know, we're going to share this knowledge and we're going to do this together and create a comfortable, safe space for this to happen. And so he started doing that. And I started to fly back from Chicago pretty regularly, at least once a month, flying back and then doing like workshops, then kind of like setting up, showing different techniques, things that I'd learned at Columbia, things that I'd learned from Peter, but we weren't outfitted to do, like Nepalese paper and stuff like that. And just started to do workshops. And eventually we had such a buzz happening that we decided that we needed to create this into a program that we could share with veterans all over the United States. And so Drew Cameron coined it combat paper back in 2006, I think. It's like, I'm calling it combat paper. And I think it's a very, you know, it's a perfect name for the program, working with combat veterans, cutting up their military uniforms.
Right.
And so my challenge, you know, living in Chicago and not really being there on the ground, was to try to get it out of the studio, to get it into universities, or to get it further than just, you know, the basement broom factory space that it was in. And so I started to contact special collections all over the United States at different universities, saying, hey, we're making this paper out of combat military uniforms, and we're looking for funding to create a tour or a tour model where we travel around and work at different communities with different veterans who have come back.
And so, right. And let me ask you a question. So, or you went to Columbia College for graduate school, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
So you were in grad school and you're talking about special collections libraries.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So when I was at graduate school, Bill Drendel was there at Columbia. And one of the things he did was he encouraged me to donate any of the editioned artist books that I made to different special collections libraries. And I was like, I never thought of that. I didn't even know what a special collections library was.
Right.
So I did a lot of research and I identified like 50 different special collections libraries that I thought would be really cool to be in.
Uh-huh.
And so I sent them emails, said, hey, I'm working on this project. I'm a student at Columbia College. And can I submit a book as a possible donation for review to your collection?
Mm-hmm.
And I started sending these books off. And of course, they all accepted them. And they sent me these wonderful thank you letters. And so in some ways, or I guess in that way, I was able to see the special collection library system with my books. And so I wasn't just cold calling. I was basically emailing these people that I've already contacted.
Yeah.
Hey, this is the latest project. You know, we're cutting up uniforms and we're pulp printing onto the paper. Poems and images from people's times in the service, and the special collections libraries across the board. I think there was only one that I got rejected from, but across the board they said yes. Send us, you know, a portfolio. Send us a group of prints. Send us a single sheet of paper. We'll pay for it. We want to support this project.
Wow.
And so that was how Combat Paper was funded in the very early days, was through special collection libraries purchasing work, essentially. And so you can see that if you go to WorldCat, you know, you can see all the different stuff that was created back in the 2007, 2008, 2009 time period. But about, I would say, 80% of our operating budget came from special collections libraries. And so that was kind of really exciting. So then I contacted DCAM and I was like, hey, check this out. I got these people that want to buy the work. So let's make some work. And so that was part of what I was doing when I would return to Burlington to work with the veterans, was like Drew had said, hey, I've got, you know, 8 guys coming from Fort Drum. They're just back from Iraq. They're bringing their uniforms, their active duty. You know, I can't be around. Will you work with them this weekend? Mm-hmm. And so I think that was right before the Friends of Dart Hunter conference, that I was working with a few folks from Fort Drum or active duty, and they cut up their uniforms. I remember going to try buy beer for us, mm-hmm. because they carded everybody, and I was the only one that was over 21, so I couldn't buy beer. I was like, what? These guys just came back from fighting a war. You can't sell them beer. And the it was kind of like through part of what I was doing was going back and then kind of setting up the studio and then running these workshops with veterans to create work that we could then sell to the special collections to keep the project going. And the second part was to try to get it out of the studio. I know we had funding to do stuff, but we, you know, it's kind of struggled to find organizations that would host us, because the idea of cutting up the military uniform at that time was kind of controversial. Mm. And so I think I don't know how many people I emailed, but I did a lot of cold emails because I didn't really have the experience with doing workshops at universities at this time. And so I just sent out a bunch of emails, and St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, contacted me and said, we are totally into this idea. We would like to support this project, and we'd like to have a workshop. And so on Armistice Day or Veterans Day of 2007, we did our first workshop outside of the Green Door Studio papermaking, working with veterans from the Vermont National Guard, from Fort Drum, and from all over the United States through the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And St. Lawrence University really kind of, I think they took a real risk, you know, mm-hmm. To support us in bringing all these GIs to kind of voice their anti-war experience and cut up their uniforms. And so we made paper there. And that was really the beginning of Combat Paper Project. That's really when we launched it. Because from there, I could say, you know, we've got work at Harvard, we've got work at Yale, we've got work in all these different special collections, and now we have this like papermaking workshop that we've done at a university where we brought the veterans in. And so that really helped, you know, push Combat Paper out of the old papermaking studio and into the university system. And so from 2007 until late 2010, Drew Cameron and I traveled, you know, all over the United States doing workshops and, you know, making paper with student veterans, making paper with the Veterans for Peace organization, making paper with Iraq Veterans Against the War. And so we were just kind of like traveling around in this tour model, making paper and picking up, you know, veterans in different like airports who would join for a little while and then they would fly off and then new ones would come in. And so for those years, it was very active, working almost solely with veterans who had come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, cutting up their old military uniform, focused on broadcasting an anti-war message. You know, partway through that that time, it was around 2010, so it was close to the end, we realized that mostly through feedback that we were getting from the VA hospital and some of the art therapy community, that by focusing on an anti-war message, we were limiting our audience, right? Mm-hmm. So we were only able to kind of bring into the workshop setting people who were already anti-war. So we were in many ways just preaching to the choir. So sure, we were providing service for these veterans to voice their opinions and things like that, but it was all just very one-sided.
Right.
And so around that time period, we decided to kind of like change combat paper to make it more open, to make it open to civilians, to make it open to people who were proud of their time in the military, people who were not proud of their time in the military, so that it was more open. And that really took a lot of effort. We basically had to go back to the website and recreate all of our language. We had to police the whole, our organization from the different associations with Iraq Veterans Against the War. So we dropped that and kind of like hit it in the past somewhere. And what was really interesting for that last year, year and a half time period when we did open the workshops up, it was amazing and to see how these communities would come together and they had the shared experience of serving the military or having friends and family who served in the military. So they spoke a common language, but they had different viewpoints and they would come together and celebrate their time and celebrate their voice. And it really felt like we were engaging in a very democratic experience for the people that we were working with. So I liked that. And that was one thing that kind of like I noticed immediately. It was like once we got rid of that anti-war sentiment and we could open it up, it was about people sharing their human experience in war or being related to war. And that really turned me on to kind of like continue to look. I mean, that's when the door opened for me to kind of come into a peace paper project.
Right. Wow. Okay. And let's just mention that combat paper still continues in some iteration with Drew Cameron, and I'll have him on the podcast.
Oh yeah. You
should, sometime definitely. Soon. So,
yeah, because basically what happened at that point was, around 2011, I mean, combat paper was growing so fast. We went from, you know, squeezing money out of my bank account to earning, like, I think the last year that I was involved with combat paper, we had over $116,000 annual operating budget, most of which was through donations.
Wow.
And so it went to actually being like a lucrative project.
Yeah.
And you know, a viable project. And
right.
So that was something. And so we were growing so fast. And, you know, with all these kind of different things that happened, when you grow fast, it was like, what do we do? How do we go forward? Mm-hmm. And, Wounded Warriors through the what's it called, the Combat Paper New Jersey, which is now Frontline Paper, was interested in getting involved. And there was a number of the veterans that I had trained. There's John Turner, there's Nate Lewis, there's Eli Wright. These folks were able and ready to run their own programs.
Right.
So it just made sense for me to kind of step off of Combat Paper and then create something new and different.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about the upcoming 12 Months of Paper notebook that will be coming out this fall. Many of you are familiar with the 12 Months of Paper calendar, a how-to book and calendar featuring a paper project every month. If you've made any of the projects, I'd love for you to post and tag your images at 12 Months of Paper. That's hashtag 12 Months of Paper. And if you haven't made any and you're just curious, you can go to that hashtag and see what people are making. In 2020, I'm changing the format a bit. I'm creating a wire-bound book, still featuring 12 paper projects. And this year, 4 of the projects are designed by guest artists. I can't wait to share those with you. I'm also partnering with Arnold Grummers to include a teeny tiny papermaking kit for making your very own sheets of plantable paper embedded with seeds. Stay tuned for more information, and there will be information about the upcoming edition of this book at bit.ly, that's bit.ly/12monthsofpaper, where you'll also find 2019 calendars available at half price.
So that was kind of for the birth of peace paper. Mm-hmm. What happened was I decided, you know, that in stepping off of combat paper, what was the next step? What was the next thing that I wanted to do, and the next, maybe the next group I wanted to work with? And so Margaret Mahan and Gretchen Miller, who's an art therapist, and myself got together. And Gretchen Miller, who's Gretchen Miller is an art therapist. And so she said, you know, one of the things that you could consider doing is making paper with all these different healing populations. So survivors of cancer, you know, incarcerated youth, survivors of sexual violence, things like that. And then still using the rag and the story in the rag as a vehicle for these workshops, but actually use them as focused healing workshops. So working in direct collaboration with art therapists. And I had no idea about art therapy. I didn't even know it was a thing. I think we would joke around about it, but like, this is art therapy. Mike Blake from Combat Paper used to kind of put up these signs about art therapy, and it was kind of a running joke in the veteran community, but it actually was its own discipline. Yeah. And so that seemed like a really unique niche and also a challenge, you know, for me to learn something new.
Mm-hmm. And where were you living now? In Chicago still? Or
Who knows? With Combat Paper, basically, I think in 2007, December of 2007, I gave up my apartment in Chicago.
Okay. And
so I was
you were traveling. All right.
I was traveling, yeah.
Yeah.
I think at some point I was living in Pittsburgh, and that's when I got really connected with the art therapy world. Okay. So I think when I came back from Europe at some point, and I just got an apartment in Pittsburgh. And started learning about art therapy. But yeah, the whole time it's very transient. You know, my life is still pretty transient.
Right. So describe a piece paper workshop.
Oh, so generally speaking, a piece paper project workshop is focused on the community that we are servicing. So say it's cancer survivors, maybe it's cancer survivors. And so they run anywhere from 3 to 5 days, generally speaking. And people bring in the clothing that they associate with their traumatic experience or their you know, troubled past or their survival story. And what we have them do is we go around in the beginning because most people don't know each other. So the workshops could be as small as maybe 6 people, as big as maybe 50. And we have them go around and introduce themselves through the story of their rag material that they brought in to transform. So through kind of speaking through the rag material, they're kind of talking about their story, their triumph, their ability to survive and their willingness to, you know, combat these problems. And they get to know each other. And so these, you know, at first these workshops always start, it's like clockwork. They always start with people kind of really tightly kind of closed up and clinched up, and they don't know each other. They don't know the process that they're about to get involved with. They don't really know what they're getting into or why they're there, you know, or what we're going to do. But the workshops, you know, they always start where people are very tightly guarded and like afraid of, not afraid. They just don't really know what they're getting into. So they're, you know, they just kind of are closed up. And then after they introduce themselves through the rag material, they have a sense of who's all there. So there's this community, and generally speaking, they're all very similar. They all have a similar vibe of story, or you know, they find some common ground with each other. And then, you know, myself and whoever else is working with me will take a shirt or something that we brought, and we'll demonstrate how to transform it into paper. And so we could say, okay, so now you take scissors and we cut this material into pieces, and we demonstrate that. And I think that's the most difficult part of the workshop for these individuals, is the actual act of taking scissors to the material and cutting it into pieces.
Right.
Because what happens is people will lay this material out, you know, they'll pet it, they'll comb it, they'll, you know, look at it, they'll tell stories. There's a lot of tears during this time.
Yeah.
And the scissors usually are just within hand's reach, but not cutting up the material. And then somebody will start cutting, and you can start to hear snipping. Slowly gets into it. People start tearing. Some people cut exact squares. You know, they're very, you know, exact with what they do. Some people tear, and once the material starts to transform in that way, there's this energy that's released. So people start to like talk more. There's much more engagement. And then we have each individual go over to the Hollander beater or the Hollander beaters. Sometimes I've traveled with 4 different Hollander beaters. And they load their material into the Hollander beater. so say a t-shirt, and we might run a t-shirt in the Hollander with a little bit of abaca for about 20 minutes. That's about right. I drop the roll super fast, and they'll actually stand there the whole time. We give them earmuffs, you know, so it's not super loud, and they run their hands through the beater basin, and they're physically kind of like feeling the material as it transforms into paper pulp.
Right.
And this is very, I think, significant. So each individual actually goes through the process themselves. They load it into the machine. Of course, we assist, but they stand there and they watch it and feel it transform. And then we bring it out onto the paper making, you know, into the paper studio, and they're able to make paper from their t-shirt. So they might get 10 or 15 sheets of, you know, 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper with a t-shirt, you know, depending on the thickness and how much they're paying attention. And so it's that first moment when they dip in the mold and deco into the vat, and they pull it up and they shake it and they see it kind of form, that they get that smile on their face. And again, this tension is kind of released, and they're like, wow, okay. And so they might make a couple more. And then after making a few sheets of paper, people start to look around the room to see what other people are making paper out of.
Right.
And different colors and the different, how the different materials that people brought in transformed into paper pulp. And they might grab a donut or a cup of coffee and kind of go around and visit with people as they're making paper, and kind of share in story and just in friendship now that develops. And then at the end of that session, we introduce like double couching and pulp printing and kind of more creative processes with the paper. So sharing the fibers and layering the fibers. And so then people who are comfortable, which is usually about 98% of the folks who are involved, will say, yeah, I've got lots of pink over here. I've got lots of blue. I've got lots of black. And so people start doing these layered, you know, pieces. Uh-huh. That are unique and individual, and making art pieces that are using the community fibers, so using everybody's fibers together. And that's pretty exciting. So that's usually a 3 to 5 day process that we go through to do all that. And then the very last thing we do is with the dry paper, we'll do bookbinding and some kind of creative writing. On paper. The last thing we really want to do is have people take something out of the closet that they put in, you know, they've had this experience in the clothing and they put it in the closet and they don't want to get rid of it. They don't really know what to do with it. And they take it out and then they make paper out of it. The last thing we want them to do is put that material back into the closet. We want them to activate it in some way. So whether it's through pulp printing or creating creative sheets or making a book or making a journal or writing letters. And so we try to get the people who are participants in the workshops to activate the paper so that they feel comfortable sharing the paper. They feel comfortable using the paper. They feel comfortable getting it out there. And so we encourage people to give it away. We encourage people to write letters to friends or family. And we try to start that process. That took a few years to figure out, especially with combat paper, people would come back, we return to different locations and people would say, oh man, I pulped my BDUs and I love the paper so much. I put it back in the closet and I can't wait to use it someday. And you're like, no, you're supposed to use it. You're supposed to get it out there and share your story. So, you know, we basically designed the workshop in a way that allows the individuals to activate the paper and get them to feel comfortable using it. I think that's as important as the cutting up of the material. The cutting up.
I like that phrase, paper activism. Activating the paper. Cool. Yeah. I want to ask you about, you talk about the four beaters, and I know you went through developing a portable beater with Lee Scott McDonald, and tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so back in the early days of combat paper, you know, we had this idea of sneaking a Hollander beater on base. And so we needed to have a Hollander beater that was more portable than the David Lena beater that we had that I bought, or the Valley that I bought.
Right.
Porcelain colanders are awesome. They're great, but they're a little bit too heavy for the work we were doing. And so I contacted Lee McDonald and said, Lee, we're interested in having some kind of portable design. And, you know, originally I contacted David Rainer because he had built the 2-pounder that we had. I said, David, you know, would you be willing to make a smaller version that's portable? And David said, well, I basically have my model that I create. So no, I'm not that interested in that because he has this thing. And so I called Lee and Lee was like, you know, I've been thinking about this. You know, I've been thinking about the idea that you could have a small beater engine and you could basically build a basin out of whatever you want. You could build a basin out of a bathtub, you could build a basin out of, you know, plastic material, whatever. And so he said, so we're halfway there already. And so I said, well, I would like to have a portable Hollander beater that could be human powered and that weighed less than 50 pounds so that I could not only work with the, you know, with the a combat paper project because we were traveling so much flying, putting it in the back of our car, but also I'd like to be able to bring it overseas. So mm-hmm. I was headed to India. And so that was the first place that we were going to be using this machine in. And so Lee really kind of like said, yeah, I see there's a market for this. I see that this is something that's possible being the engineer that Lee is. And so I paid him right up front. I think it was $4,500. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, here's $4,500. And then he spent about a year and he built it. And Lee is amazing. You know, he basically every screw has a weight, every component to that portable Hollander beater that we travel with is engineered so that it's the strongest, most functional and lightest weight machine possible. Yeah. I mean, it weighs about 20 pounds.
Wow.
The Hollander that I have here, and I've got one in the States.
Uh-huh.
But that suitcase model without the motor, yeah, it's somewhere around 20, 23 pounds. And so it can fit into a suitcase with packing, no problem.
Right.
And so that's really all Lee. You know, all I did was ask Lee if he could make a portable Hollander beater.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's definitely become the main component. Without Lee McDonald's portable Hollander beater, you know, combat paper, sure, that probably would have continued to exist because we were able to operate out of papermaking studios around the country. But Peace Paper Project certainly would not exist without Lee McDonald's Hollander beater and without him kind of, you know, creating this innovative technology that allows us to make paper all over the world. So, Lee is kind of to credit for all of that.
Right. And Lee, for those of you who have never heard of Lee McDonald, he had a papermaking tool supply company for many years and now makes these Oracle beaters, right? It's called the Oracle?
Yeah, it's called the Oracle.
Right.
I think, okay. Yeah, because we would always, the name the Oracle came from that we would ask the beater where we were going.
Uh-huh.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay, so where is Peace Paper going? And just tell me a little bit about the trajectory of Peace Paper.
Sure.
It's still going.
Peace Paper is alive and well. So Peace Paper Project is an international organization of hand paper makers and art therapists and social activists and advocates and fine artists. And so since 2011, when we established Peace Paper Project, we've set up over 40 studios around the world. So they are in Australia, Turkey, Iran, India, Ukraine, Poland, Germany, United Kingdom, and all over the United States. So each one of these different locations uses hand papermaking as a form of social engagement and art therapy and fine art making. And so it's really a community project in each of these locations. So there's not one person that's running these. It's a group of folks. Most of them own a Lee McDonald Oracle Hollander beater.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them own a Critter, for better or worse, and a few of them have made their own, which is kind of the way that we're going now. And so each one of these locations uses hand paper making as a way to address specific issues to those communities. So the folks in Iran are doing paper making for different reasons than the folks in, say, Ukraine or in Northern Ireland. And so each culture, each community is using hand papermaking as a way to address the specific issues of those communities. And that's kind of what's really exciting. And Peace Paper Project is, you know, born out of the requests from the art therapy community and continues to operate in that way. So where is Peace Paper going? It's, you know, my headlights can only go so far. Basically, I'm responding to the requests from the communities around the world that email me and say, hey, I'm interested in having a Peace Paper Project developed here. You know, some of the projects that are on the burner right now is one is, you know, working with the prison system in Minnesota. Another two of them are working in Rwanda and Sierra Leone, taking machetes from the different civil wars and genocides that happened there, and then using those tools to create the Hollander beater and then run workshops working with survivors of the different civil wars and genocides in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. So it's kind of always changing and evolving, and that's basically what I can say about Peace Paper. It's alive and well, and you know, Peace Paper Project has grown so fast. And the thing that I learned, I think, from Combat Paper was that I think it's better to train people and help them kind of run their own programs in their communities and not kind of hold on to the name brand and try to like bring everybody under like one kind of business umbrella, if you will, and kind of be in charge. So what I like to do is go in and we run like a basic workshop to see if the community responds to it. If they do, then we can apply for grants and funding from those communities, often state run, State Department stuff. And then I go back and then I do a training on how to use the equipment. We do like a small workshop and then these individuals run the program themselves. So it's more like their Peace Paper Project affiliated studios. So they're owned and run and operated by those communities. So they're not tied to us. So I don't have to go every year to these places and make sure that they're cleaning their Hollander properly. You know, they're
right. And so do you have like a set of guidelines and then they're just hiring you and paying you to come a couple of times?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So most, the way that Peace Paper Project, and I'm happy to send you my PDFs from the last, like, I don't know, 8 years or whatever of Peace Paper Project, if that's of interest to your, you know, the people that are listening to this podcast, I'm more than happy to share them.
Okay.
But the way that Peace Paper Project is financed is through the tours that I do in America. So I travel around America doing these lecture and workshop tours, kind of talking about Peace Paper Project, talking about the different programs, and then actually doing workshops with students or with the community. And then I get paid, or Peace Paper Project gets paid an honorarium, which then I take as much of that as I possibly can. And then I earmark it for different programs, whether it's the program in Mumbai or the program in Ukraine.
Ah, I got
these programs, in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. And so I take as much of the profit that I earn through those tours, and then they help launch these programs. So everybody in America has to pay. Unfortunately, that's just the way America is. And then I take the money from America and then I use it to basically start these programs abroad for the people that are more needy than the average American.
So you're using it to travel and to basically fund your time in the other places. You're not paying. So you're helping them figure out where to get the money to.
Yeah. So I get people. Yep. Exactly. So it's kind of like mini grants. Like last year we were in Mumbai and we worked with an organization called the Gabriel Project, and they contacted me about 3 years ago and they said, will you come and help us create a papermaking program that employs women in the slums of Mumbai? And so I worked with them over the course of a couple of years, kind of designing the project. They built a studio, so they were partially funded by the, largely funded by the Gabriel Project. And then I went in with Jana Schumacher and we spent 2.5 weeks training the women how to make paper. And now the program employs three women that make paper for soap wrappings. So that's kind of an example. So we used our funds from the lecture tour to basically pay for us to travel to Mumbai to be, do these workshops. Or Ukraine is very similar. Most of the projects work like that. It pays for the travel. It pays for the the lodging. Often it pays for the purchasing equipment or paying for somebody to build stuff, things like that. Especially when you get into these countries or areas that don't have a lot of funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what's a couple of lectures for me is, you know, a livelihood for somebody else.
Right, right. And so your, when is your U.S. tour and how can people who are listening who might want to have you come see them? When is that and how do they contact you?
So the tour, generally speaking, is somewhere between the middle of August and the end of November. So around Thanksgiving. Operates on the fall academic calendar, really.
Okay.
And all of the workshops are free and open to the public, unless it's like at a hospital or something like that.
Right. But
there's always lectures or there's a couple of free days. But, you know, through peacepaperproject.org, people can go to the activities page and they can see the whole
lineup.
The lineup.
Mm-hmm.
The tours in America are getting smaller because the tours in Europe and abroad are getting bigger. So what I've tried to do is I've tapped a few folks from the United States who are going to basically carry the Peace Paper Project torch forward as I kind of segue more with more focus on Poland, Ukraine, and Germany, kind of working with refugees and people who are survivors of the conflict with Russia right now.
Right. Wow, what amazing work. Well, let's wrap up with you telling me about St. Pauli Paper Studio in Hamburg, which...
Oh, I would love to.
Yeah.
I think, personally, St. Pauli Paper Studio is the best studio in the country, but I only say that because it's mine. So I'm very excited. St. Pauli Paper Studio is the home base for Peace Paper Project in Europe. And we have, you know, I don't know how many molds and decals, but we've got lots of molds and decals, Nepalese and otherwise. And we've got one Hollander beater. I just ordered another one from Lee that I'll bring over. And besides kind of doing community engagement projects all over Europe, using hand papermaking studio, because it's much easier to travel within the EU having a home base in the EU. Very easy to throw the studio on the train, and I don't have to go through customs or passport control of it anymore within the EU. But besides running those programs, which are, there's many, many going on, St. Pauli Paper Studio has a visiting artist residence component as well. So 4 months a year, we're seeking different papermaking or printmaking or art therapy professionals who are interested in coming to Hamburg. They basically stay in a small one-bedroom apartment that's in the studio, and they can learn more about pulp printing. They can learn more about, you know, silk aquatint, or learn more just about papermaking, and actually volunteer and work with the different workshops that are with the refugees or that are, you know, with different populations throughout Europe. So they can do kind of a teaching and learning and fine art residency here in Hamburg. So we'll be hosting four individuals a year here. So that's one of the things that I'm really excited about, is that I can bring people to the studio and work directly with them instead of me having to travel to them.
Right.
I can bring them in. And so we will be bringing the women from the Mumbai slums who don't have passports or even the money to take a train to the airport. We're going to bring them in and work with them. We're going to bring in the artists that I've worked with in Poland and Ukraine, and, you know, a number of artists from America will come over. And so I'm really hoping that the St. Pauli Paper Studio will be kind of a hub for the Peace Paper Project to do a lot of its fine tuning for individuals who are very interested in learning some of these techniques and how to bring that stuff back to their communities.
Right. And so is this residency by, are you picking people or is there an application process?
There is an application process. I haven't put it on the website, but basically we're full this this summer. So we've got three individuals coming this summer, and then January and February are already full. So we're already full for the year. So I could easily, I think, fill it. But basically, the initial folks I've handpicked. Mm-hmm. But I think sometime this fall or in the winter, I'll put up an application. It's going to be, you know, I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to kind of select the individuals to come. I think to begin with, it's going to be people I've already worked with before.
Sure.
That want to do training, and then we'll open it up from there. It'll cost a little bit of money, mm-hmm. but it's not that expensive at all, mm-hmm. comparatively. And Hamburg is an awesome city.
Super. Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
And the studio is like right in the heart of it all. So cool. You just walk out the door. You know, first you walk out your apartment door and you're in the papermaking studio.
Uh-huh.
And then you walk down the stairs and you walk out your door and there's cafes and there's bars and there's, you know, there's squatters like quarters. There's bow wagons. There's everything is right there. So it's really exciting. It's a cool space to be in. I look forward to bringing that to the hand paper making and the art therapy and the fine art community that for people that are interested in coming over. We did a program with interns, you know, Peace Paper uh-huh. Project the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, you know, even with Combat Paper, we had a lot of interns coming over. We've kind of pulled back from hosting interns. We'd like to have people that are more adept and, I guess, independent and mm-hmm. kind of they can go back and do more with their experience. So interns tend to get in the way more than they actually help.
Right. They take a lot. They have to manage them. Yeah.
Kind of drop that component.
Very cool. And so who is with Peace Paper now? You and Jana Schumacher, anybody else on the ground there?
Oh, on the ground here. No, it's just Jana and myself here in Hamburg. Mm-hmm. In the States, Johnny LaFalse is mm-hmm. Is in Saranac Lake, New York, and then Stephen DeSantis is in Portland, Oregon. And so those are the two guys that I'm working with right now to basically kind of hand the torch over to those guys. And there'll be an East Coast and a West Coast. And mostly Johnny and Stephen will be doing training workshops. And then training different organizations how to make paper and how to kind of use the studio. One of the big components that we're rolling out this fall is working with communities to build their own Hollander beater. So I think we're doing three different workshops throughout the United States where people are getting an old bathtub. And then Johnny and myself are showing up and then we're working with the community for 3 or 4 days to build a Hollander beater. And then we're doing a weekend workshop where we basically use the Hollander to train the community how to use it, how to make paper, and then how to kind of continue to run their program with this kind of DIY Hollander beater approach. That's kind of the new model.
Wow. Sure. And is this a bicycle powered or electric?
This would be the bathtub Hollander beater, or we're calling it the DIY Hollander uh-huh. beater. It's about a 4-pound Hollander beater. It costs about $1,500 to build.
Uh-huh.
Pretty awesome. It's run with a 1/2 horsepower motor. You can put a full horsepower on there if you want. But the thing that is, I think, interesting to us and why we're interested in is that, you know, the community has like all the pieces, all the materials in it to make the Hollander. So we just show up with some basic blueprints and we go to the machinist or the auto mechanic shop and they build us a roll and a bed plate. We go to the hardware store, the used building material center, get the rest of the materials. And it only takes a couple days to assemble. And then we've got a Hollander beater going. And so we did it this past fall successfully. And then this tour, we're actually trying it in 4 different locations in the U.S. where we're kind of giving it a shot. We'll see if it works. And from there, I'm hoping it's the new model. And a big reason that we're doing that is because we're not sure how long David Reyna or McDonald will be building these machines.
Yeah.
And so what we're hoping to do is kind of inspire a new generation of Hollander beater builders. So we're hoping that through the process of kind of like actually doing this and, you know, building Hollanders using the community materials, people will look at it and say, hey, that's a cool idea. We want to do that. And then they might actually, you know, do something similar and then actually sell a product or make some new innovations to the Hollander beater. But like,
yeah, that's a fantastic thing, because I get emails quite often of people looking for a Hollander beater and yeah, the expense for one of a David mm-hmm. Reyna is way more than what you're quoting. And mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a need. That's a hindrance for a lot of people from even setting up a studio. Mm-hmm.
That's actually, yeah. And I've noticed it with my, I mean, I'm sure you get emails on a daily basis.
No, not that many.
But I've noticed it with my international travels, like the work that I did in Poland and the Ukraine. Both of them were interested in this idea of having a portable studio that could travel around and service different communities throughout Poland and the Ukraine.
Yeah.
There was a lot of interest, but to pay for Lee McDonald's, Lee McDonald's, the price of Lee McDonald's Hollander beater was more than 2 years' salary for the average Ukrainian.
Right, right.
So they're not going to buy a freaking Hollander beater.
Right.
So what I did was I brought Lee's over, and then we basically made a knockoff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So with Lee's permission, I showed up, and then I worked with the different mechanics and engineers, and then in 1 week time, they built a Hollander beater. And so that's kind of what gave me the idea. I was like, oh, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you know, right.
And I'm not a machinist or a mechanic, you know. I do good by other things, but that's not my forte. And so 2 years ago, I was asked to do a residency or design a residency for a makerspace in Burlington, Vermont called the Generator. And they said, what would you do? And I said, well, I think I would try to make improvements on my tools that I work with. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about like 3D printing molds or something. But actually through looking at what they had and my experiences, I decided that the real challenge was to try to design a DIY Hollander beater that would give me the experience of building one so that I could travel around and continue to assist communities building them. But also it gives the world this knowledge and this information that I kind of develop, you know, to give it to the world for free, basically. So that's kind of what I ended up doing there.
Right. Wow. Well, Drew, you've made so many contributions to the world of paper and the wider world. And I want to just circle back around to your father, because it seems like even though you lost him when you were so young, you've kind of carried a lot of him with you. And done really meaningful work and related work.
Well, thank you. I think that, I'm a product of my mom and my dad. So,
yeah,
definitely.
And your mom,
I think,
sure.
I like to, you know, especially growing up without my father, I always kind of wondered what he would think about the work that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I like to think that I've been making him proud.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you are. Okay, well, thanks for coming on Paper Talk and sharing your story with us.
Okay, thank you. And I will send you any files you want.
Yeah. We'll have a web page with all of your information.
Okay.
All right. Bye for now.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
besides the season, the main contender.